Okay, so I want to return to that situation that we were at the end of last time. I didn't quite finish with the discussion of the Peter Weil related stuff. So remember that inside of L2 of our compact group, we've got the continuous functions, and then inside of there we have the ones that are span when you generate representations from the function by translating, you get something finite dimensional. And we call such functions, the space of such functions, we put a zero here. And that thing, this is a kind of algebraic Peter Weil. You have an algebraic direct sum of, maybe I'll write it as NCV, although it's also convenient. I mean, we want to go back and forth. Sometimes think about it as a tensor product of V and V star. Anyway, I didn't say before what the maps are in the two directions, and I want to sort of fill things out by actually doing that. We have maps going both ways, alpha and beta. These are inverse to each other. Okay, so these are mutually inverse isomorphisms. The one that's the easiest to think about is the alpha that goes from the left to the right. And this one, it's a very simple conceptual thing. Suppose you start off with your F, and we send it over here by means of alpha. That thing is supposed to be a direct sum of guys. I mean, so it has a bunch of components, one for each representation pi. And the component at the representation pi is just that operator pi of F. Okay, so we have pi of F. But it's not just one single thing. So I don't know how to indicate it, but it's put parentheses around it. It's a whole family of guys, one for each pi. Maybe I'll put it like a subscript. It's the family of those things. In the other direction, so now we need beta. When I go the other direction, I find it more convenient to think in this other description where you have V tensor V star. It's the more traditional way, and let's write down a typical thing, V tensor V star. Okay, so that's something living in a particular one. You know, I'll just take a single, this is a direct sum, I just have to say what happens on a particular pi V. I'll take that guy there. This will go back to something that's more or less what's called a matrix coefficient. I'll just write the formula and then say a word about it. You get the dimension of the representation, pi, times a function, which will write F subscript V V star, and then I have to tell you the definition of that. That's a function, and its value on G is, well, what you do, let me make sure I get the, yeah. I want to do it this way. What's going on here is, I mean, V is a vector in the representation. V star is a representation in the dual, so it's a linear functional. Given a linear functional, of course, you can evaluate it on a vector, so that's what this thing is. It's just linear functionals have values on vectors. And here we apply the group element to that dual vector. So this thing is more or less a matrix coefficient, what's called the matrix coefficient, but rather for, it's actually for the contra gradient pi star, literally speaking, but it's, anyway, some kind of matrix coefficient, up to some kind of normalization. I should say that, I guess. So if we're in a special case where we have that the value of the linear functional on the vector is 1, then that thing is what's called a matrix coefficient for, actually for pi star. Then F V V star is a matrix coefficient. For actually pi star. If I had put the G over here in front of the V, then it would have been a matrix coefficient for pi. And you can go back and forth between the two. I mean, putting this over here, if I just move it over, it would pick up a G inverse. So the two things are related just by inversion on the group. It's not a big deal. Okay, and now I want to just sketch the proof of why beta is the inverse of alpha. So sketch of proof that beta equals alpha inverse. The first thing to notice is that both alpha and beta commute with both of the G actions. So they're actually G cross G equivariant. That's one thing to note. You just check that from the definitions. But now, when you think about, let's say the right side where you have V tensor V star, we're thinking about things as G cross G modules, and that thing's irreducible. V tensor V star is an irreducible G cross G module. So that's another thing to keep in mind. And just combining these facts, you see that beta must almost be inverse to alpha. I mean, you see, the thing that's not clear is this factor of dimension pi. But just using these facts alone, you're going to be able, if you think it through, you're going to be able to see that the inverse to alpha must send V tensor V star to some multiple of this. It's just not clear that that's the correct multiple. So we have to figure out why that's right. Therefore, I mean, the first two points imply that beta has the correct rough form, has right rough form. But then we still have the remaining question, why do we get dimension pi? Why the factor dimension pi? And for this, one way you can argue is to use one of those formulas from last time. I had a formula from last time that said that the value of one of these functions like this that's in this sub-zero space, the value of that function at 1 was equal to a certain sum of things. So apply that formula from last time. Should I write it or not? I can't remember what I called it last time. Maybe I didn't give it a name. I don't know. Anyway, let me just write it out. Well, and as I mentioned last time, you can either put the star in or you can delete that star. So that's really a fancy looking star. But you have this thing saying f of 1 is a sum over pi of the dimension of that space of pi times this trace. Apply this formula to the function we're dealing with. Apply this formula to the function f v comma v star. I'll let you think it through, but I mean, that works. All right. Now, the ones where you do make this assumption that v star against v is 1 are the most interesting ones. Let's do that. And then we'll get sort of a nicely normalized matrix coefficient. Choose the V star. So it's like that. We use the isomorphism. All I'm doing now is identifying the inverse of alpha. I'm not reproving the Peter Weyl theorem. I used it in this algebraic form. All right, so I used that alpha was an isomorphism. but it was not clear what the inverse was. All right, and so here I wanted to actually determine the inverse. That's the point of this. All right, make that choice, and let's now I'm going to really put notation to the test here, or put your alertness to the test. Here I did V star, and now there's going to be a subtle difference. Okay, so it just means I interchanged the roles of V and V star, so it means that the G now is going to go over in the other location. All right, so this is the other alternative I spoke of, where the G goes in front of V. And now that's a matrix coefficient for pi, not for pi star. And if you use one of the other formulas from last time, so again, I guess we need to recall. Let me get all the symbols correct. So recall from last time, this formula, where we integrated over conjugacy classes. In this case, we integrate. F was supposed to be one of these nice functions in the sub-zero space. But we integrate over the conjugacy class of G for this function. And we had that this is what came out, a sum of the irreducibles. Character value at that conjugacy class times trace pi star F. Remember that this actually was the thing that gave us this formula. This other form is just a special case where G equals the identity element. But the more general thing is this one here. So now apply this. Apply this to this function we have right here, the one where I switched the roles of V and V star. Take that as our function. And what do we get? So it's going to tell us about the integrals over conjugacy classes of this particular guy. Okay, so in words, what that thing is, those are the integrals that's the integral of the conjugacy class of G of this matrix coefficient for the representation pi. And what comes out from this formula is that you get the dimension of pi inverse. Somehow, that's why I had to talk about this, that dimension of pi is coming from this calculation up here when you track through the stuff, and the character value. Well, okay, so what's happened here is that the sum over pi has gone away, because all the terms are zero except for the specific one that we're working with. Here pi was a variable thing. Here we have a specific pi, and for the specific pi we got this function here. And then you only have one term in the sum. Just that pi occurs. And you get the value of the character. Well, almost. I mean, you're a little bit off. But essentially you can say, if you take a matrix coefficient, if you integrate it over the conjugacy class of G, you're going to get essentially the value of the character at G, up to this slight discrepancy of the dimension of pi. All right, and so this thing here, I want to sort of, in a way, this is the main, so this is an important fact. It's simple, but it's an important fact, and it's kind of, this is one of the things in this story for compact groups that, in a sense, generalizes to semi-simple groups. In a sense, I mean, we'll see as we go on that it becomes more complicated. But nevertheless, there is some kind of generalization of this particular thing. All right, so it's a good way to think about what's going on in the compact case, because it's generalizable once you've figured out what the generalization is. The subtlety, I can already say now, is that not only do you have to consider these integrals over conjugacy classes, but you need certain weight factors. These, such an integral is called an orbital integral. The orbits are conjugacy classes. Orbit here just means G orbit for the conjugation action. That thing on the left is an orbital integral, but in general, you need weighted orbital integrals to get these character values. So we will see that the weighted orbital integrals that occur in the global trace formula actually occur in this kind of local context when you move from compact groups to non-compact groups. But well, then we don't want an abstract non-compact group, but we want a Lie group coming from a reductive group. But then it works more or less the same way over either the, you know, it doesn't matter if it's over the reals or the p-adics, you still have some kind of, always some kind of generalization of this. Okay, but now I have a sort of confession to make, which is that I've spent all this time proving this important fact, and you may have the impression that we had to go through the Peter Weyl theorem and all these steps. That's not at all true. This important fact is completely elementary. It's simpler to prove than the Peter Weyl theorem. So you shouldn't think of it as being the end result of all these steps. I want to formulate this as an exercise. Just prove this important fact in a few lines. So just give short proof of the important fact. That is not using any machinery, just use that you have this representation, pi, and a vector in it, and a vector in its dual, and just sort of fiddle around. But I'll give a hint. The good way to attack it is to look at the matrix version of this. These are, once you choose a suitable basis, that function can be thought of as the matrix coefficient of pi, or some specific one. It'll be one of the ones on the diagonal. What you can do is just consider. Right? I don't want to give the whole thing away, but just consider the following expression. It'll be an operator, but it's the analogous thing. Okay, and if you look at that's a matrix value, that's a pi of this variable thing. It's a matrix value function. You integrate it, you get a matrix, and you can consider the matrix entries after choosing a basis. If you set things up, one of those entries will be this thing. But you can analyze this more easily, so I'll let you think about it. Now, before moving on, I want to make just a few comments. I've already made the main one, which is that this kind of equality here is something that we want to look at for non-compact groups. That's the main point. But I want to say something else because, again, there's something. If you think about it, you may find confusing, or not confusing, but rather puzzling, or something. Namely, why did we use one of these matrix coefficients rather than the character itself? I mean, why don't we here, as our function in this formula, why don't we take the character? Well, we can do that. So let me make some comments. One is another basic thing in this story for compact groups are the orthogonality relations, which say that when you integrate over the group, the character of one irreducible against the character of the contragradient of something else, you get sort of the Kronecker delta. I mean, I'm abusing notation. That Kronecker delta means it's 1 when pi 1 is isomorphic to pi 2, not when it's equal, but isomorphic. Anyway, just the proof is so short, I can't resist recalling it. The left-hand side is the dimension of the G invariant vectors in this tensor product here. And that's the same as the dimension of Palm from one to the other. So when pi 1 and pi 2 are isomorphic, the dimension of the space of G maps is one dimensional. When they're not isomorphic, it's zero dimensional, so you get what you should. Two is it's more or less a restatement of one, but in a version where you plug functions in to as test functions into some other, the trace of some other representation. So let me write it like this. We look at the trace. I'm using notation compatibly with the previous one. So I look at the trace of pi 2 contragradient, but I look at it on the, now I can think of the character of pi 1 as a function on the group. I mean, it is. It's a, the character of pi 1 is a perfectly good continuous function that we can treat as a test function. But I mean, when you write it out, I mean, that's what this thing was. Okay, that's another way of saying this left side of this thing. These are just the same, really. And so again, it's the Kronecker delta. But now, what you see is, from the point of view of taking traces of representations on this function theta of pi 1, actually we get the same results as if we took that other function. Well, I guess I get, we'll get the same result as if I took dimension pi times this function. So anyway, so now I want to continue. So using, darn it, where was it? I recalled it, yeah. Up here, I'll call this thing dagger. But using dagger as before, as we did a few minutes ago, we see that when we take this orbital integral, we have this fact. Okay, so you can reason as before and conclude that. But now again, I have a confession. That fact is completely trivial because the thing that we're integrating is a class function and the integral goes away. So this equality is completely trivial. But why did I, so why did I bother to say it? It's because it's saying for this purpose, this function here is like this other one. Where did it go? Yeah, this one here. So this function is a matrix coefficient, and it has the property that its orbital integrals give you the character values up to this factor here. Well, the character also has the property that its orbital integrals, which don't change anything, give you the character. So the reason why I bring it up is because you're going to be asking yourself, why didn't I use the character? And it seems kind of stupid to go through all this stuff and use these matrix coefficients when it would have been simpler to use the character for the same purpose. But the, I think you can guess the answer, which is that I've already said in the non-compact case, these are the things that, this is the picture that generalizes. This picture is not going to be so good. In a non-compact case, it's hard to even make sense of the character, although that's a deep result of Harishchandra, that there's a way to make sense of that character, which starts out life as a distribution. You can prove that it's a function. That's not at all obvious. You certainly can't define it as the trace of the operator, because the operator is on an interdimensional space. You can't just define it naively. But there's some sophisticated definition that works. But then what happens is you get a function in the end after a huge amount of work, but then the function has singularities. As you approach the identity element, for instance, it blows up. And so it's not suitable for taking as a test function. It's a discontinuous thing as you approach the origin. And anyway, so you don't end up that guess for what you might do, you don't do it. What you work with are these matrix coefficients. That's the good point of view. All right, so, okay, so to summarize what I just said, so on a compact group, I can use theta pi instead of this function f v star v, but in non-compact case, I'll just say this, we use matrix coefficients. In a non-compact case, you still have some trouble with matrix coefficients. By definition, your representations are continuous. The matrix coefficient will then come out to be a continuous function. That part's fine. It's continuous. but it won't necessarily be compactly supported. Often it is not, which means that it's, you do have some problems with it. Okay, that finishes up what was the stuff that is a continuation of last time. Now I want to do something a bit different. So what I want to say by way of introduction to that is that we've seen these orbital integrals appearing. They're one of the main characters in harmonic analysis on reductive groups. These characters due to Harshchandra and orbital integrals and so on. There's a short list of kind of important players in the story of harmonic analysis on local groups. And I want to actually illustrate by means of examples how orbital integrals work, especially in the group GL2. But before doing that, we need some these are just some preliminaries, just so you'll know what the meaning of the various. I don't want to assume you already are very familiar with integrating on p-adic groups. I want to say a word about how these things work. Maybe enough just to get by with. What kind of groups are going to be relevant here? So now I'm throwing away the real case. It's similar but different. I mean, so we want to definitely take something p-adic. Okay, so G is going to be a locally compact Hausdorff topological group, but I want it to be of a very special type where there's a neighborhood basis at the identity of compact and open subgroups with neighborhood basis at the identity element of compact open subgroups. Well, all the groups that you're going to get out of when you start with a p-adic field are going to be like this. So for instance, well, take F to be a p-adic field, a finite extension of QP. That field itself is a group under addition, and that has this property. So that's an example already inside of, I'm going to always use this kind of notation here. So F will be our p-adic field, and I'll always write O for the valuation ring inside of there. Well, the valuation ring is a compact open subgroup, and moreover, as you take all the various ideals, pi will be not just a representation, but now it's a uniformizing element, prime element. So we can look at the next thing down, which is the maximal ideal, et cetera. Pi squared times O, pi cubed times O, those things, as they get smaller and smaller, they form a neighborhood basis at the identity element consisting each one of a compact open subgroup. Of course, F star is similar. It already inside of there you find at the kind of at the very top O star, the units in O, which is a compact open subgroup. And then inside of here you find 1 plus pi O, the units congruent to 1, et cetera. The units congruent to 1 mod pi squared, blah, blah, blah. They go down, get smaller and smaller, and show that this works. Or if we take, you know, GLN of F, and it's a similar story, then we have a very big compact open subgroup, GLN O. But you can make that smaller by looking at the guys that are congruent to the identity. It's completely similar to this. We can look inside of here at things that are G in GLNO, such that G is, oh, I'm sorry, that's probably messing things up. G in GLNO, such that G is congruent to the identity matrix modulo pi to some power. So that's a compact open subgroup, depends on what you take K to be, but as K gets bigger and bigger, they get smaller and smaller, and they give you your neighborhood basis that you wanted. All right, so these are the kinds of groups that we consider. If you take a reductive group and take the p-adic points of it, you get a group like this. What kinds of spaces are going to come up? Well, sometimes other auxiliary spaces will come up, like a homogeneous space for G. Now, a homogeneous space for G is usually not itself a group. Nevertheless, it looks and it behaves in a sort of similar way. And how do you kind of write down what that story is? Well, we also want to consider certain topological spaces. I'll write them like this, LC, TD. LC is for locally compact. Hausdorff is understood here. TD is for totally disconnected. And what does it mean? This just means that X, every point, what's the definition? Every point in X has a neighborhood basis of compact open subsets. Doesn't make sense to say subgroup anymore, but anyway. Okay, so it's the analogous thing for the spaces, like for the groups. And when we take a homogeneous space, take one of our groups. Oh yeah, I will want some sort of short way to refer to those. Let's call those LCTD groups. But if you divide one of these nice groups by a closed subgroup, that homogeneous space will be a typical example of the X's that we need to consider. So e.g., G mod H, where this is LCTD group, and this is a closed subgroup. All right. Now, as you should know from analysis, I mean, there's a integration theory whenever you have locally compact Hausdorff spaces that's based on looking at Borel measures where you take measurable sets that are generated out. You start with the open sets to sort of generate what you can out of those. But in this theory where we're working with p-adic kinds of things, or actually totally disconnected sorts of things, there's a simpler version. You can apply that general theory. It's certainly correct to do that, but you can also just think about it more naively, and that will do for our purposes. In other words, we won't attempt to integrate every possible measurable function. There's lots more measurable functions than we're going to be considering here. Instead, let's look at these functions here. These are functions, complex-valued functions on this group, let me actually just work with X. There's no reason to make it be a group. But suppose it's one of our totally disconnected guys. We want to look at certain continuous complex-valued functions on here, but much more than continuous. This upper infinity means locally constant, which is a very great strengthening of continuous. Locally constant, and as usual, sub C means compactly supported. So you have to think a little bit what such a function looks like, and when you think about it, you see that if you have a non-zero value of that function, and then look at all the points where that value occurs, that set of points where that value occurs is going to be, if it's a non-zero value, it will be a compact open subset, just by the way we've set things up. And so the way you actually specify such a function is you take a finite collection of disjoint compact open subsets, and you just assign values on each one of those, and then on the complement, you just have the value zero. So the structure of these things is really simple. They're just finite linear combinations of characteristic functions of compact open subsets. Okay, so compact open subsets give you the building blocks, you take the characteristic functions, everything else is just obtained by linearity out of those simple guys. Okay, so every function in here is a finite linear combination. There's no analysis going on. Finite linear combination of characteristic functions. One sub, I don't know, C, where is a compact open set. Compact open subset. And as I say, you can even make the sets disjoint when you form this sum. That's the most natural thing to do sometimes. Anyway, that means if we're going to try to integrate these things, really all you have to do is assign measures to compact open subsets. You don't need all measurable subsets. The ones that are really relevant are ones that are as nice as possible, both compact and open. But the cases that matter for us are integrating on the group or on one of these homogeneous spaces. Let's start with the case of the group. I want to say a word about that. We need to be able to integrate on the group. All right, so to one of our functions, we want to associate its integral. That'll be a linear map like this. Integral f maps to integral for g, f of g. Well, okay, so we need to choose a Haar measure. Dg is a Haar measure, and our linear functional depends on that choice. But in this group case, you have to think through the definitions and use the fact that in this group, we at the identity element, we have a neighborhood basis of compact open subgroups. And what you see then is that the basic things you actually have to integrate are, when you think it through, you see that you don't have to consider arbitrary compact open subsets. You can, the building blocks are even simpler than before. What you need to take is characteristic functions of cosets of sufficiently small, we have to let them get smaller and smaller. So every F is finite linear combo of guys of the form characteristic function of K times a group element for some G and G and some sum. We can't fix it in advance, but some compact open subgroup of G. So those are the building blocks. But the thing is a Haar measure, and well, okay, so the integral the integral of this guy is, of course, just a measure. But, well, now here, I'm going to have, of course, if I do it like this, then I have to specify now whether I meant a left Haar measure or a right Haar measure. I don't want to bother about that because the groups we're going to be working with are going to be unimodular. And because we don't have any need for the general case, I'm going to let's assume DG is left and, at the same time, right invariant, i.e., G is unimodular. I just don't want to bother with the general case since we don't need it. In that case, it doesn't matter. I mean, the measure of KG is also, I mean, this is the measure of K, and it's also the measure of GK. I mean, it just doesn't matter. So all you have to do is you have to know how to assign measures to subgroups, and then everything else is determined. And how do you assign measures to subgroups? Well, okay, you pick some compact open subgroup, and you're going to have to pick what you assign to it. That's arbitrary. But once you've made that choice, take some other subgroup that's smaller than it. Okay, you're forced to define it, because the bigger subgroup is a union of a finite number of cosets of the smaller one. So you're forced to say that the measure of the smaller guy is the measure of the bigger guy divided by the index. You must do that. So everything is pinned down once you just say what the measure of one compact open subgroup is, and then everything else is determined from there. Measure of K. So what am I trying to say? Suppose that K contains K prime, then the measure of K, I just said it, is the measure of K prime times the index. K is the bigger one. And everything is determined from there. Now, pushing these considerations just a tiny bit further, you see that actually what's going on is truly algebraic in the sense that this map here, which is going to be surjective, that's for sure, this surjective map identifies the complex numbers with the space of co-invariants for this thing. When we have a group acting, and I can, since I'm in the unilateral case, I can make my group action be either on the left or on the right, just as you like. Talk about left translations or right translations. I don't care. Just pick one of them. But with that group action, you can do two things. You can look at functions that are invariant. You can take invariants. Well, that won't be very interesting usually, because if it's going to be compactly supported and invariant, then the group is going to be compact before you get anything non-zero. So looking at, if the group's non-compact and you look at invariant functions, you just get zero. But the co-invariants are, it's the biggest quotient where the group action becomes trivial. So we need a general definition. Suppose we have, it's just an algebraic definition. So we have G and a representation. I'm not using the topology here, just so even if we have an abstract group acting on just an abstract vector space, that's fine. If I ever write V upper G, it means these are the invariant things, V and V, such that GV equals V for all G. Okay, that's the invariants. But what are the co-invariants? The co-invariants are the dual construction where you look at V, and then we divide out by all the guys that are preventing the action from being trivial. Namely, we divide out by the stuff spanned by the guys GV minus V. So let G range through all G's and let V range through all V's and take all those vectors. If we divide out by all of them, then the action on the quotient becomes trivial. So that's the co-invariant. So the point is that this thing here, the algebraic thing that's going on. There's the C is the co-invariance for that action. And you can interpret it, as I say, either way, either the left translation action or the right translation action. In both cases, you have this conclusion. Now that helps us to analyze what goes on for a homogeneous space, is which I need, because we're going to be doing integrals over conjugacy classes, orbital integrals. And an orbit is a homogeneous space, G modulo the centralizer. And we need to work. In fact, I'm going to do calculations on GL2, so we really, we have to know how this stuff works. Not just abstractly, but really understand how it works. So we want to jazz this up by discussing integration in a situation where we've got a unimodular G and a closed subgroup H, which is itself unimodular. Okay, so that's going to be, we have a group as usual, LCTD, unimodular, closed, unimodular. Oh, I meant to say, and then I forgot to do it at the relevant point. When we take reductive groups, they're always unimodular. All right, so the things that are of most basic interest, they're always unimodular. When we deal with the closed subgroups of a reductive group, then it depends. If you take, for instance, a proper parabolic subgroup, it will never be unimodular. Okay, so non-unimodular groups do come up in a very natural way. However, we're not going to be using parabolic subgroups, at least today we won't. And so I won't discuss them, and I will assume that it's unimodular. Okay, so now we need to think about the following operation, where what I'm going to do is integrate, not over, I'm going to take functions on G, but I'm not going to integrate them over G. Instead, I'll just integrate over all the various cosets of H, and in that way get a function defined for each coset of H. And the rule, of course, is that F goes to integrate over H, F of, I'm doing it on the right, Okay, yeah, so actually, I mean, I need to fix my Haar measures on both G and H. Let me call them DG, DH. Okay, so this thing is a function on this is a function in this dot here. Dot is the variable, and that's a function of dot. Okay, so it's a natural thing to do. You take your function, you make it invariant under right translation by H by just integrating over those cosets of H. But now what we have to think is, well, what do I want to say? I mean, we also have the integral that we had before, okay, just integral over G of whatever, dG. And then we have this thing that we just defined. But actually what's going on is that just as the complex numbers are the co-invariants for the G action on here, this thing, this quotient, somehow by doing this integral, we obtained functions which are H invariant. And so that in that quotient space, the right action of H has become trivial. But in fact, it's the universal thing. This thing, it's the co-invariance for what we started with. But now with respect to H, and it matters, I'm talking about the right H, this is the right H action. Okay, so that's what's going on here. But then that means this is going to be a quotient of that. So in other words, we're going to get a uniquely, there will exist a unique thing here. And what that is called is integration over the homogeneous space. So we give it a name. It's written like this, integration over G mod H of whatever. And to a convenient way of remembering the measures we started with is to write the measure on the homogeneous space as G modulo DH, just a kind of device to keep track of that. All right, so the upshot is the integration by stages formula, or integration in stages, I don't know, formula. We take a function as usual, locally constant contact is supported. If we want to integrate the thing over G, we can you can first integrate over H, then over G mod H. So that's the inner thing. And then we have this dg mod dh. So you see why one writes the measure as dg mod dh. Then it's sort of the dhs cancel out and you're left with dg like you want. All right. I already explained which functions spaces we care about. Namely, we are interested in orbits, and in that case, we'll be looking at the group mod the centralizer of some point in that orbit. This next section, maybe I'll just call it basics on orbital integrals. I'll just state various things that you need to know to believe that this stuff works, with some rather incomplete discussion of why it's okay. So F is still our chaotic field. And G, now I want G to be specifically a connected reductive group. So G is GF, where this thing is a connected reductive group. over f. And now let's take some element gamma in the group, and we can look at its when I say periodic field, it means finite extension of QP. That will be our convention, just to avoid having to think about what happens when you have various things associated with inseparability and other technical nuisances that occur. Well, we want to consider the conjugacy class of G, maybe so. We're interested in the orbit of gamma equals conjugacy class of gamma. Just set theoretically, that thing can be described as the quotient space by the centralizer. So G sub gamma will always mean the centralizer of gamma, the definition. Centralizer in G of gamma. And, well, of course, it's the obvious thing. We use the group element to conjugate the given gamma. And in that way, we have a bijection just of sets. In favorable circumstances, this is a homeomorphism. And it turns out that these circumstances are favorable. So in this case, we can say the following two things always for any gamma, even if, you know, for every single gamma in G, we can say that, first of all, that orbit is a locally, it's always a locally closed subset of G. So it's open in its closure. It's a good subset topologically. And moreover, this is a homeomorphism. Okay, so facts one, the orbit is always locally closed and is closed, which is the best of all possible worlds. It's closed when the guy is a semi-simple element. When, as soon as you have a non-trivial unipotent part in your Jordan decomposition, then it will really only be locally closed. Okay? And is closed when gamma is semi-simple. And two, sorry? Precisely when. And this is a homeomorphism. All right, so this orbit really can be thought of simply as that homogeneous space. You would always have a continuous map, but in some unfavorable situation, it might only be continuous bijection, but if you were unlucky, maybe it wouldn't be a homeomorphism. Although only actually very weak hypotheses are needed for that. But now we have an interesting thing that occurs, namely, when you look at a function on the group. So suppose I take the nicest possible kind of function on my group G, namely, you know, locally constant, compactly supported, like usual. Now suppose that we just restrict that to the orbit of gamma. Okay, if you do a restriction of a locally constant function, for sure it's locally constant. If you do a restriction of a compactly supported function, well, are you going to get something compactly supported? It depends on whether you restrict it to something closed. If it's closed, sure, because the intersection of a closed with a compact is compact. But if you intersect a compact with something locally closed, okay, it may not be compact. So we get into trouble because we start off with a nice function on the group, which is compactly supported. We restrict it to the orbit, and it may not be compactly supported, which means it's not going to be clear that when we do the integral over the orbit, that that's going to converge. In the case where it is compactly supported on the orbit, then the integral really boils down to a finite sum, as we've seen, because you can boil things down to linear combinations of characteristic functions. It's really sort of an algebraic, finite thing. What happens in this bad case when your element is not semi-simple, so that the orbit is locally closed but not closed. When you write out your integral explicitly, it really turns into an infinite series, is what it boils down to. It's still kind of algebraic. It's not, you know, all of these things are algebraic in a sense because the discrete nature, but it comes out to be a convergent infinite series of a kind of algebraic type. Usually they're sort of a geometric type of series, not something really esoteric. But nevertheless, there's a convergence question. So third fact is despite, let's see, I just want to summarize what I just said. When gamma is semi-simple, so that orbit is closed, convergence of orbital integral is clear for the reason I just said, because the restricted function is again compactly supported. And when you view it as a function on the homogeneous space by means of that homeomorphism, it's compactly supported on the homogeneous space, so we can apply this machinery. There's no difficulty. When gamma is not semi-simple, convergence is not obvious. It needs to be proved, but it works. I mean, it is convergent. You get convergent infinite series. It's a fact. It's not obvious, but it's true. And we're going to, well, we'll work out one example for GL2, so you'll get a sense of, so you'll get a sense of these things. Yeah, I didn't write it down in my notes, but I'm going to do it next time. Yeah, there's actually two references for that. Okay, let's see, what can I say? Let me just, I'm almost out of time, but let me illustrate this business of what orbits look like in the case where we're going to study these orbital integrals in some detail to get a feel for them. Let's take the case of GL2. So G is GL2 of our p-adic field. Okay, then we can define a map to just a product of two copies of the field by associating two, G is a group element, so it's a 2x2 invertible matrix. Associate to G its trace and its determinant. In other words, the coefficients in its characteristic polynomial, just two of them, the trace and the determinant. It's, of course, for GL2, it's almost true that you can recognize when two guys are conjugate by testing whether they have the same trace and determinant. Of course, it's not quite true. It's almost true. So usually, let's call this map beta. So usually, usually the fiber the fibers of beta are single conjugacy classes, but not always. The exception in the case where in the cases where the fiber is not a single conjugacy class, then it will consist of two conjugacy classes. Just this is kind of Jordan, you know, canonical form types of stuff. The only way you can have exception is if you have a scalar matrix. A scalar matrix is by itself, that's a conjugacy class. But there are other matrices having the same trace and determinant as this guy that aren't conjugate to it, namely, we have the conjugacy class of a zero, well, whatever, one, but that's something who's with the same eigenvalues, but that's not conjugate to this one. All right, so these guys here give the cases where the fiber splits as a union of two disjoint orbits, and well, they're all orbits are disjoint, then two orbits, and the rest of the fibers are single conjugacy classes. Now, because this is a continuous map, that's for sure, these are continuous functions, every fiber is closed. Okay, so all fibers are closed. That's just clear, because it's continuous. All fibers are closed. And so here we're seeing an illustration of this principle that when you take a semi-simple element, you get you always get a conjugacy class that's closed. If it's what's called a regular semi-simple element, where the eigenvalues are distinct over the algebraic closure, then it's then we're in the case where we have a single conjugacy class and it's closed. This conjugacy class, this guy is not semi-simple, so this one is not closed. That's only locally closed. This one is semi-simple, and well, it's just a single point that's closed. Okay, so in this case, we see that it's working the way it's supposed to. All right, so this is where I need to stop for today.